With one final heave, you feel a splatter of mud on your cheek, and your cart begins to move again. After 2 days' journey, you finally crest the hill to see the wooden fort of Kraków high on its stone mount, overlooking a bustling town, seemingly at the intersection of all the roads in its area. You continue with your fellow villagers into the town center, where you begin to sell your goods to the passing merchants. Today, you are bringing more of your village's specialty, honey and wax. For these, you find eager buyers from a passing band of Greek merchants, who exchange light Byzantine gold coins for a healthy amount of honey. One of them speaks a foreign yet understandable Slavic language, and tells you how to use your stock to make honey fritters, which he says are a specialty back home in Constantinople. You wish them well as they depart, and soon the day is filled with further exchanges, until almost your entire cart has been emptied. No doubt, a valuable day for the village. As you and your friends depart, you cannot help but notice the abundance of other activity within the market. It seems the most popular commodity of the day were the slaves who were captured in a recent raid to the north, and you see a group being split between Muslim traders of the great Iranian Empire to the east and Jewish and Christian traders of the Frankish Empire to the west. More curious sights await you at the eastern edge of the market, with an arriving group of Scandinavian men, carrying a cartload of furs and a small troop of slaves. With them is what appears to be a Christian missionary, now bounded to be sold. You leave by the road which follows the Vistula, and alongside the whole way are a flurry of ships traveling to and from the growing Kraków. Among them, you overhear the language of the Balts, no doubt carrying amber down the ancient road to the Mediterranean. It has been a full and active day of trading, and your village will be pleased with the small pile of Byzantine golden solidi and Arabic silver coins, along with the array of vegetables and spices which you now carry with you. You cannot help but feel that this land is changing, and that the town will soon be able to expand its reach from all this activity. This is perhaps for the best, though, so long as your new patrons keep the men of your own village out of the slave markets. Welcome back to Between the Seas. Last time, we introduced the series with a look at some abstract building blocks which together create order for a locality. Today, we will apply that thought to the Riverlands, that great region between the Carpathians and the Baltic Sea, and look at its pagan society during the 9th and early 10th centuries. To get started, let's take a step back to get a clearer look at the scope of our story. Inner Europe we have defined as the massive region which is fully contained within the greater European peninsula, but which is cut off from the oceanic highways that surround it. Framing it this way splits the continent of Europe into three super-regions, those being Mediterranean Europe, defined by access to the Mediterranean Sea, Maritime Europe, defined by access to the Atlantic Ocean, and Inner Europe, which is defined fully within the continent itself. The boundaries between these regions are more like gradients. The western boundary of Inner Europe can be considered to be those areas of Germany which are oriented outward to the North Sea. This, then, excludes the Low Countries in northwestern Germany, with the Rhineland and Burgundy leaning more towards the maritime region. The southern boundary of inner Europe, meanwhile, is defined somewhat clearly by the Alps, with the unclear portion being the Balkan Peninsula. For our purposes, since most of the Adriatic coast does not possess easy access to the interior, we can consider Dinaric, Pindus, and Balkan mountain ranges, all as gradients between inner Europe and Mediterranean Europe. What then does this leave us with? So far, we have been speaking in terms of three smaller regions, to better understand the mass of inner Europe. The plateau covers Swabia, Bavaria, Austria, and Bohemia, while Carpathia covers the rest of the Danubian watershed. These two regions have made up the majority of the story to this point, along with contributions from maritime and Mediterranean Europe, in the forms of the Franks and Romans, respectively. This has been done primarily due to the relative lack of sources in the remainder of inner Europe, but also to introduce the major influences affecting inner Europe from these vital western and southern flanks. The plateau and Carpathia combined, however, make up less than half of inner Europe's total land area. The rest is consumed by the vast plains, hills, and swamps to the north of the Carpathians, the Riverlands. I believe that when talking about the Riverlands, it can help to think of inner Europe as two halves rather than the three regions. The bottom half is Danubia, following the Danube from Swabia all the way to the Black Sea. Danubia will consistently be more influenced by the institutions and developments of maritime and Mediterranean Europe, as we have seen so far with the Roman and Frankish developments there. The Riverlands, meanwhile, will plot a more ambiguous course. While they would be heavily influenced by developments from the Western Sea, they will also more closely integrate their societies with elements of culture from the steppe, and influences from the trade routes which connect the rest of Eurasia to Europe. The result will be the ability for a more independent development, able to lean more into one influence or the other as the situation unfolds. The Riverlands possess immense distances compared to the more broken sites of Danubia. The Greater Riverlands stretches all the way from the Elbe River to the Ural Mountains, and much of this land will follow a similar course of development until the 13th century, at which point the apocalyptic Mongol invasions will lead to significantly different situations for the local populations. We will say that for inner Europe, the Polesian marshes and the flat steppe of central Ukraine will form the eastern boundary. Though especially at this point in the story, these arbitrary boundaries do not mean much. The outer Riverlands and the Pontic steppe, then, will serve as the conduit for the other great influences on the inner Riverlands. So what has been taking place in this land since we last left it, back during the earlier days of the Slavic migrations? As it turns out, quite a lot. Despite not having much sources, it is known that these centuries were times of immense change for the region. Two wider cultural groups now dominated the entirety of the land, those being the Balts and the Slavs, both of whom remained pagan going into the 10th century. The Balts were more well established, with a shattered array of tribes controlling the supply of amber to much of the world ever since the Bronze Age. Despite this wealth, traders of surrounding cultures were content to leave the land as it was, due to its relative isolation, rough terrain, and ferociously defensive cultures. Despite the dominance of a mostly homogeneous language and the sharing of many religious traditions and customs, both the Balts and the Slavs would be, politically, extremely fragmented, and quickly develop a multitude of different and opposing tribal identities and subcultures. We will return to the Balts in an episode soon enough, as the Curonian tribe rises to prominence. But for this episode, we will focus on the Slavs of the Riverlands. The Slavs, at this point in time, made up a large majority of settlements within inner Europe. They would inhabit some very rough land, especially in the early Middle Ages, which was colder and wetter than later periods. Despite this, they would adapt to the land with a remarkable effectiveness, and come to form powerful entities by the High Middle Ages. So, to understand how this situation would come to be in the upcoming centuries, we should try to understand Slavic society and culture, and track its changes over time. A good starting point for this would be to understand the societal implications that come with paganism, which would remain the worldview of much of inner Europe during this period. Even after the introduction of Christianity, the prevalence of paganism during this crucial period of social change would affect the later societies. I like to think of paganism as a sort of zealous agnosticism. There are, of course, many branches of paganism, but among them are many similarities. At its core, it attempts to explain the world around it by identifying nature as divine, and personifying aspects of it so as to better understand them. Because of the mighty forces of nature and the fickleness of life, it views humanity as a simple extension of nature rather than above it. The world, then, is naturally placed quite low in terms of desirability and power, matching the low status of the individual. Because of this contrast and perceived importance, pleasing nature becomes of prime importance. Although pagans may not fully understand the world around them, they know enough to follow the will of their superiors and to keep them happy. All of this leads to a central focus of paganism within Europe, the idea of fate. People's lives are seen as already written by nature, with the heroic thing to do to be to simply accept your fate, thus aligning yourself with these divine forces in harmony. For the Celtic, Germanic, and Norse, Baltic, and Slavic pagan religions, the fate of a warrior and of many men was seen to be to die a glorious death in battle. This would then please the world around them and allow their spirit an enhanced place in the afterlife. The concept of an already written fate, while inspiring some heroic individual actions, comes with some severe consequences for pagan societies. The main one is the response to a systematically negative environment, which is, oftentimes, to give in to fate and essentially look inward rather than trying to recover the situation. You can see how this would be a problem when the warriors, who make up the leaders of any entity at the time, see it as their fate to die a glorious individual death, rather than focusing on the long-term leadership of their people. However, some aspects of European paganism would actually mix quite well with the introduction of Christianity, and work to create the unique Central European environment, social structure, and ideals of the Middle Ages. The first is recognition of the importance of self-sacrifice. For the pagans, this was to align with their fate and subordinate position to nature, while for the Christians, this allowed them to better follow the actions of Christ. Self-sacrifice would be an important aspect of the Christian ethos. An expansion into these pagan realms, in some ways, allowed for a refocus on this aspect, which had been obscured by the rationalism of the Hellenistic tradition. Let's talk about Slavic paganism in particular, though. Not many specifics are known about Slavic beliefs and rituals, due to most sources only coming from later Christian writers, specifically referencing their conversions. The central deity, representing the power of sky, lightning, and the patron of war, was named Perun. Perun was universally revered across the Slavic lands, with some seemingly considering him a lord or divine superior of the entire pantheon, with others simply revering him along with other beings. And that brings us to an important distinction. There was no one Slavic paganism, and different populations placed different emphases or even had different entities altogether. One element of paganism is that it is quite interchangeable among different pagans. Different groups may add or adapt their own deities to match neighboring groups, or pick up elements of divinity as they expand. This type of reconciliation would be known as syncretism, and would both serve to make cultural differences less meaningful, as utilized by the Romans, while also lessening rigidity of beliefs, leading to many offshoots of the same tradition. This too was the case with Slavic paganism. Three other powerful natural forces, the sun, the moon, and fire, also possess their own respective deities, with Svarog being one tied to the forge, or fire in general. He seemed to be particularly worshipped among the Pelabian Slavs in the Western Riverlands, perhaps mirroring the increasing presence of ironworking in the area, which we will get to later. Several other local deities existed, which represented different forces within nature, though these seemed to be less universal among the Slavs. Each of these natural forces would possess their own associated rituals, which also varied by region. These included sacrifices of all sorts, including limited human sacrifices, according to some archaeological evidence, but also rituals such as creating bonfires and wearing amulets shaped to mimic an aspect of nature. This belief system was upheld by pagan priests, said to be able to communicate with these gods as representatives, and along with them were wooden temples within population centers, which usually contained extensive idols of the pantheon. Besides these leading figures, though, there were several aspects of Slavic paganism, which represented more so the Slavic culture. Part of this was special veneration reserved for certain natural features, such as meadows or groves. These were said to be places where supernatural beings often interacted with the world on Earth. The places which held perhaps the highest veneration for the Slavs, though, were natural springs, along with the rivers, ponds, and lakes which they produced. The early Slavs had always had a close connection to water from all the sources which describe them, with the Byzantine Emperor Maurice describing the Slavs as being the people most at home in the water. This connection would remain close across the Riverlands, which was dotted and crossed at almost every point with bodies of water, which ranged from lakes to marshy floodplains and wide river valleys. This was especially true throughout the early medieval period, as the local climate was wetter and colder than it would be for the rest of our stories. Mirroring these mystical natural places were mystical supernatural creatures who inhabited them. Most were ambiguous characters, who could decide your fate in an almost playful manner, depending on the story. Especially true of this theme would be a waterman of sorts, who could be seen to potentially be present in nearly all bodies of water, but especially those confusingly peaceful, or deep springs and rivers. There also existed a more harmful water nymph, known as Ruzalka, known to attract and then take people into the waters of the Riverlands. This being was so synonymous that they would be associated with the dead themselves. There were also supernatural figures specifically associated with the dead, though, which can tell us something about the cohesion of these Riverlander societies. The proper method for releasing a soul from the dead was said to be cremation, and this is what was practiced across Slavic lands. Souls which are either wronged or forsaken by their social peers, or who died an unnatural death but were not burned, were said to be prevented from resting into eternity. This would in turn shift them into all sorts of supernaturally haunted monstrosities, driven by vengeance and wrath. Their powers range from shape-shifting to supernatural strength to possessing the powers of animals. According to stories, they were just as likely to turn into a witch as they were a werewolf. And it is actually from Slavic folklore that many of these figures would be introduced into the wider European mythos. A notable example of this would be the vampire, which was a form of these monstrosities who lurked about at night, killing villagers and sucking their blood. We can learn from this that most communities believed in respecting the status of their peers. And this is respected in the largely egalitarian social structures described by the sources we have on early Slavs. This, too, we will explore more soon. Above all, Slavic culture and religion can be seen to focus around water, agriculture, and harmony. This would become the focuses of their societies, which would subsequently strengthen the preference further. The combination of stretches of gravelly and subpar farmland, but the Slavic focus on building agricultural societies, as well as their emphasis on freedom for the smaller communities among each other, likely contributed to the vast and rapid nature of their migrations across inner Europe. Small groups would be encouraged to migrate when the best land was taken, and a focus on agriculture likely led to large surpluses as the climate slowly warmed, thus promoting migration even further. As land was exhausted, chain reactions would then propel groups in every direction. The pattern of agrarian life was what motivated all Slavic societies. On the cultural level, this meant several agricultural festivals, with the main one being Rusalia, taking place around Pentecost and celebrating the completion of spring. This event was celebrated in the pagan tradition through references to many monsters of the dead, and through special celebrations with the various supernatural beings and places. Even after full Christianization, these festivals and many of their practices would continue, clearly being baked into the culture itself. The traditions and society of the early Slavs, though, would adapt as the Slavic migrations had brought their populations from the obscure edges of inner Europe into majority possession of it, including countless strategically and commercially important areas. Eventually, their expansion would also come to a halt with the encounters of more densely populated and fortified Germanic communities on the Elbe and Upper Danube. At the same time, the diminished trade routes would begin to steadily recover, as the chaos of the Roman collapse, the wars of the Turkic Khaganate, and the Islamic conquest all receded across the world. The wealth of the Middle East, which had at one point sustained the entire Mediterranean world, began to reopen as the caliphates entered into regular relations with those around them during the 8th and 9th centuries. In addition, Slavic cultivation of the riverlands and integration with previous societies would lead to a boom in the region, and soon villages would begin to specialize with various goods of the fields and forests. Beekeeping became a popular mode of productivity in the region, as well as harvesting furs and processing tar and wax. Different crops would find suitability in different areas, and fish would begin to flow in from the Baltic Sea. The Amber Road, once so vital to the Mediterranean, would find solid footing once again, leading also to a revival in Baltic society. By this time, the Slavs would represent the largest group of non-Christians inhabiting Europe, and with their central location, the slave trade would also begin to be a massive ongoing event in the area. All of this would make the Riverlands a key node in the growing global trade routes. To the west, the Islamic Andalusians of Spain would become a huge purchaser of slaves, and routes from the Riverlands through Prague and the Plateau would begin to open up. To the south, Byzantium represented a key terminus of trade, and the Dnieper would increasingly see itself developed as the prime artery linking inner Europe to the Romans and the wider Mediterranean. To the east, the Khazar Khaganate, an offshoot of the Great Turkic Khaganate, would displace the Bulgars, as mentioned in a previous episode, and proceed to settle much of the western steppe. Although much of the Pontic steppe would soon come under control of a separate Turkic group known as the Pechenegs, both steppe powers would understand well the nomadic grand strategy, which, as we talked about in episode 1 of the podcast, was to control the trade routes which linked east to west. As a result of this, the Khazars and Pechenegs would settle down somewhat. and promote the establishment of many trading posts, which made the steppe more hospitable to long-distance trading. They would also control their tribes to allow free movement of merchants across the land, thus growing rich from the tolls that they would extract from them. The pacification for trade along the steppe connected the riverlands directly to the Islamic caliphates through the Caucasus, and to the rising Persian powers through Khorasan, and even to markets in the Far East through the wider revived Silk Road. Another factor to this increased trade would be the increasing acceptance of middlemen, seen as acceptable to societies at all ends of the increasingly expansive network. These included the more commerce-friendly steppe tribes, as well as minority groups from the Middle East, such as the Armenians, who commonly went between Byzantine, Arabic, and Iranian worlds. The most important merchant group for maritime and Mediterranean Europe would be a Jewish population which inhabited towns in Spain and parts of Italy and France. Like the Middle Eastern minority groups, they possessed connections on all sides of the superpower divide, ranging from the Muslims in Spain to towns in the Levant. These Jewish merchants would become an increasingly common commercial force within inner Europe, especially on the routes to Andalusian Spain and south to the Caliphate. They would even develop connections with the Turkic Khazars, who in the 8th or 9th centuries were said to have partially converted to Judaism. Although this likely wasn't an extensive event among their populations, it does show the changing climate of the steppe in this time. The rising commerce throughout the riverlands would have a litany of profound effects on Slavic societies there. We have already introduced the topic of the Slavic slave trade, and this period, between the 8th, 9th, and 10th centuries, would be the worst phase of it. Slavic slaves would become the most common sight in markets all across Europe, who would be brought from these trade routes to Paris, Venice, Constantinople, and more, all to be sold to the mighty Islamic powers in Spain and the Eastern Mediterranean. They would come to make up significant portions of slave soldiers in Islamic armies, take domestic roles in leading households, and also even agrarian work, which was admittedly less common. Castration and poor conditions meant a constant demand for replacements, which kept the trade routes going. For Slavic societies, this meant extreme pressure, especially from the steppe, to destroy defenses and raid for slaves. It also promoted fighting amongst the Slavic tribes, who could gain preeminence through selling slaves to these outsiders. Although the slave trade would begin to decline with further disruptions to international trade around the year 1000, as well as with Christianization of the populace, the riverlands as a pole in international trade and the profound effects on Slavic society would remain. So what was Slavic society on the riverlands like? And how would it change during the 9th and early 10th centuries, which is the time period we are focusing on in this episode? Well, it's best to start once more from the societies described 300 years prior during the start of the migrations. Groups of individuals moved in perhaps small bunches of about 40 most frequently. These groups would travel until finding land suitable for cultivation, which, as mentioned, could be far in the riverlands, which promotes fertile pockets with stretches of marsh and poorly drained land between. Once suitable land was found, settlements would then be established. These would normally be placed on terraces of dry land above a water source, preferably above the ranges of flooding, which happened quite often. From here, the land would then be cultivated, and domesticated animals brought along, normally cows or pigs, would be given their pasture to graze. Clay from the streams would be mixed with burnt elements to create an effective form of handmade pottery, and the aforementioned specialization of villages into different goods would also take place. The feature which these Slavic settlements were perhaps best known for was their characteristic sunken houses. These consisted of a rectangle or oval shape which was dug out of the ground and lined with wood. With the earth as effective insulation, a roof would then be built, either directly touching ground level or only slightly above it. This humble household would be finished off with a furnace in one corner, used for cooking and warmth. With increased settlements and increased outsider interest in the region, came much more insecurity. With the focus of the Slavic culture on agriculture, came a deep attachment between settlers and their land. This would combine with the roughness of the terrain and the generational experience of constant threats from the steppe and other Slavic and Germanic tribes to lead to a fanatical defensiveness. Even early sources on the Slavs mention this attitude and proficiency, with the Byzantine Strategikon noting to never follow Slavic forces into rough terrain, warning of feigned retreats and unmatched speed and evasiveness. One difference between the earlier Slavs and the Slavs of the more developed 9th and 10th century would be that retreating was much less of an option for settlers. Whereas previously settlements would be noted for being built in such a way that retreat into the surrounding rough terrain was a main feature, now the settlement itself was what needed to be defended. Increased trade would naturally coalesce around strategic points, and specialization of goods would mean more to lose from raiding. This, plus increased population pressures and wealth, would lead to the encastellation and fortification of the countryside throughout the 9th century. This would begin what we will call the gorge system, as settlements would now be built and modified with their nearest stronghold in mind. The centers of town would be focused on defensible spots, such as hilltops surrounding a bend in the river, or an island surrounded by water, such as the future town of Wrocław on the Oder River in Silesia. These centers would then be fortified with static defenses. The Slavs in particular were exceptionally skilled at earthworks, and so earthen ramparts, disadvantaging slopes, mounds, and earthen support would all be built around this stronghold. To top it all off, a wooden palisade or a stone wall would be built in the most defensible point. These strongholds would be known across the Riverlands as grodz, which would come to be synonymous with townships in general. Many Slavic cities still bear this name in local forms, with some notable examples being Novgorod and Visehrad in Prague, with many more towns being started around one of these forts, such as Kiev, Gniezno, Krakow, Szczecin, and Wrocław. During times of trouble, armed forces would be called to defend the grod, and residents would be held inside. Socially, clans, or specific extended families, made up the building unit of the Slavic world. From these, tribes would then be created. We have mentioned tribes before in the show, but a good way to think of what they actually are is to imagine them as another level of family, just one where different clans made up siblings or the parents or the in-laws, rather than individuals. In this way, tribes give a certain type of very close unity, unity by blood, but are of course not great for combating fragmentation. In time, most of these small units of settlers would form tribes of their own, perhaps united to a looser tribal culture. An example of this would be the White Croats, who, while forming an overarching tribe of Slavs across the entirety of the northern Carpathians, would nonetheless be divided into tribes of their own. Many of these tribes would come to form blood feuds with one another over conflicts of the land or scarcity, thus encouraging internal militarization and fortification. In time, these tribal identities would become tied to the local grod, and the blood ties would become more closely associated with the land than to the tribe themselves. This would be vastly important for the future development of the region and its society. As described for the Riverlands, these centuries were ones of constant violence. The insecurity and necessity of hierarchy to effectively direct an offense and make the most of local goods and commerce would lead to a gradual stratification of society. Traditionally, Slavic social structure only distinguished between free and enslaved individuals. Early sources tell of councils, or veche, being called to make major decisions. In some places, these decisions needed to be unanimous to have full legitimacy. These same sources also tell us of the extreme fragmentation within the Slavic social structure. These councils could apparently often devolve into infighting and violence, and loose agreements could quickly devolve as different groups fail to find agreements or meet their preconceptions. One practice would be for the council to promote an individual to lead as a prince during times of extreme danger. Once elected, the members of the council and their dependents, and occasionally even future children, would be sworn to uphold this decision, which had been agreed upon, until the danger had passed. From here, we can see how this system will interact with the increased danger and insecurity of the Riverlands. Most all tribes would have elected from among themselves a prince, whose children would come to have hereditary claims to leadership, which ultimately stemmed back from this decision of their forefathers. Ancestor veneration was a major aspect of the culture, and so the ancestors' wills could be seen as a powerful source for legitimacy. Many future Slavic dynasties will intentionally call upon these humble origins, with the Czech Premyslids as an example, who revere their founder as a just plowman. Because of the egalitarian nature of these origins, and the voluntary submission to the prince, every man was technically liable to be called upon for military aid, and so was responsible for looking after their own provisions. In this way, a large majority of the populace was armed for war, and a large proportion of the overall population could then be called to serve as light infantry when needed. Of course, a retinue was still desirable for any leader, a core force of professional soldiers, whose equipment was supported to be of above-average quality. These could then be on constant standby for raids of your own, for collecting tolls from passing traders, or for forming leadership for mobilized freemen. Again, gradually, over time, freemen who were able to obtain for themselves better equipment, or who devoted themselves to the leader's warband, would be rewarded with special privileges. All freemen could own or work their own land according to custom, but these members of the retinue would often be granted further land to better support themselves, or even given administrative duties of their own. In this way, they would come to be known as drusina, or translated, a fellowship, trusted to be the tribal aristocracy. With the rise of Charlemagne and increased trading from the west, the Riverlands would over time become very influenced by the rising aristocratic methods of governance found within Eastern Francia, what would eventually develop into feudalism. We can see a gradual importation into the Riverlands, which will adapt the system in its own way, with the two key elements of the Gord and the Drusina. An early such example of the conversion of social relationships into roles and responsibilities would be the ability to call upon the freemen of a village for aid and fortification. All would help to fortify strong points across the region. Steppe culture, too, would always maintain a separate strong influence in the Riverlands, and promote cavalry warfare as the preferred components of tribal militaries. Both the riders of the steppe and the Franks would come to possess armored horsemen, covered with either mail or a set of lamellar armor, and with Slavic ironworking taking off across the increasingly developing countryside, this would be promoted for the Drusina as well. Although the majority of the military force was still infantry, as was traditional for the earlier Slavs, a rising proportion, reported to be a third by the 11th century, would become horsemen. Supporting this was of course expensive, and so the Frankish model would also be pursued, of obligating support from the villagers to supply these more elite soldiers, rather than the common mobilization obligations from before. Doing this will, again, gradually, shift land ownership away from the individual freeman and towards the ownership of the aristocracy. At the same time, in the developing towns, which were springing up along with the increased commerce, the merchants would promote a transfer of privileges in a similar manner. Eventually, the original councils would be replaced by the veche in cities, which was more limited to participation only by the local merchants and shopkeepers, and a different council being promoted to support cooperation among multiple villages, filled more so with the local notables. Higher up, councils of the Drusina would eventually become a key source of legitimacy for the princes, calling back to the smaller-scale councils which led to their rise in the first place. All of these tribes would eventually, by the 10th century, tie themselves quite well to the land. This got to a point where the prince and the Drusina, at first tied by blood, would eventually become more of a social role, which again more so mimics the Germanic system developing further west. Certain princes could even usurp the roles of other princes, claiming legitimacy from filling that same social role in the now more firmly established social hierarchy. They would then inherit the responsibilities of protecting the village from raids, strengthening the local grod, and protecting trade. Taxes and a bureaucracy did not really exist at this point among the tribes of the Riverlands. The increasing position of the prince and the Drusina was instead supported through tolls collected from trade, which further shows the ties between this new social stratification and the growing trade networks across the Riverlands. Although international trade still remained a relatively small economic phenomenon compared to local trade and self-sufficiency, it provided enough in tolls to support this growing military elite. But, with all these tribes, it seems as though unification would be terribly difficult for any aspiring power in the Riverlands. And this is indeed true. Any sort of unification would require immense effort, individuals of extreme merit, and a significant amount of luck. The key, though, would come with a unique development of the tribal identity. Unlike the Germans, the Slavs never really developed into large tribal confederations. The Franks, the Saxons, or the Bavarians all formed as a consensus-based greater union, which ended up taking over their original tribal identities. Instead, the Slavs held to their more humble origins as an identity. However, as we have seen, the unique, small, and dispersed settlement patterns of the Slavs meant that smaller tribal identities formed layered in with the larger tribal identities, which presumably represented past communities which had since broken apart. Slavic legend still held that the entire culture descended from one tribe. In this way, the individual tribal identity could be left as being tied to a certain locality or grod, while a different tribal identity could be expanded, and with time, become the new parent tribe in the minds of these localities. This would maintain strong localism, but also kinship to the greater whole, which was owed its own unique set of obligations. These cultural bonds could become quite strong indeed, and would be central to Riverlander development in the coming century. It would be utilized first by the Moravians to the southwest, and then by a certain clan known as the Piast, who occupied the grod of Gniezno and led the small tribe of a people known as the Polans. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode of Between the Seas. There have been many tribal identities which rose and fell during this period. Many we will return to soon with the conquest of Mieszko. There have even been examples of those parent identities, with one prominent one being the White Croatians. Although the White Croats would be an example of this series' trial and error in their own lands, their offshoot down south would eventually utilize this method of tribal supplantation to create the Croatian duchy which we covered last series, which I think is interesting. Anyways, next week, we will look at another example of this phenomenon, that being Great Moravia. Until then, this has been Jacob, and I hope you can take some time today to contemplate commerce.